This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication.
My guest is Migdalia Cruz, who is a playwright. There are over 50 plays, including Miriam's Flowers and The Have Little. She has won several awards. She's taught in San Francisco at Mission Cultural Center. Grew up in the South Bronx in New York. A new version of Macbeth set in 1970s New York, translated and adapted, will be at the Magic Theater in San Francisco, Fort Mason Center, March 18th through April 5th. And for more information, you can go to magictheater.org. Migdalia Cruz, we'll get to your career, but first let's talk a little about Macbeth. The play on Shakespeare people originally contacted you and gave you a list of plays, and you looked and said, I love Scotland, there's my play. Is that sort of how it started?
They contacted me and said, we have this project, we're going to hire 36 contemporary playwrights to each translate a Shakespeare play from English to English, to modernize and the language and update it. And would you be interested? And I said, well, yes, of course, but which play? So then began the quest to find the right one. And I rejected a few. I either thought they were too misogynist, or I didn't like the poetry, or there was too male-centered. And I thought, well, but then I was looking at the list of things that were available, and Macbeth was on the list. And I was like, that's my play. And I've always had a fascination with Scotland. Since I was in college, I went to, my junior year abroad was spent in Scotland. So I had an affinity for the place, but also I thought I had an affinity for the play, because I felt like Macbeth is a play that's about the others, and people who are other, not being able to ascend in a society that is keeping them down. And I felt like, well, that's a Puerto Rican story. That's definitely a New Yorkian story. I understand what it means to be the other and to be othered in society. And I thought, oh, those are my people, the Macbeths. So I chose Macbeth, and I loved doing it. It took a long time. It took about 2 years, I'm going to say, to get to a draft that I felt was complete. And that was back pre-COVID times. I finished it probably in 2018, maybe. And then it's had some production since then and different versions of it that have come to light.
So you get this idea of Macbeth. I saw on your Instagram Richard III that had already been done.
Well, Richard III came after my translation of Macbeth. My translation of Richard III came after. But Richard III came before, in Shakespeare's time, before his Macbeth. So what I found, actually, which is interesting about those two plays together, is that he kind of repeated himself. He like stole lines from himself, from Richard III, and put them into Macbeth. And I thought, how interesting. He's like every other playwright I know, where we like steal from ourselves and like revisit themes. And except that by the time he got to Macbeth, he was such a better poet.
At that point, had Play On done a whole bunch of those, or were you kind of at the start of it?
I was kind of in the middle. I mean, they had started identifying writers, and maybe they had 14 people signed on already, or 15, and then they asked me also.
You're suddenly looking at Shakespeare and you're going, okay, there are two things. I can modernize the English, but I don't want to lose the poetry. I can modernize the story, but I can't lose the story. And I want to stretch, but I want it to still be Shakespeare. Is that going through your mind, all of that at the time?
Yes. So it was a big balancing act, you know. I was very aware of doing justice to Shakespeare, making sure that I'm always, you know, keeping his story and his poetry intact. But then, as I began working on it more intensely, I felt that that my own poetry was trying to push in also into the script, and I felt like I found a place to put it with the witches, because then I decided to embrace the witches fully and really make them be the framework of the play. Instead of just sort of like informational people that foretold things, I wanted them to actually move the action along and create the action. And for me, that was a really modern idea that Shakespeare wouldn't have had. So I felt like I could put myself into the play that way and add more poetry, and that was my own. And I thought, well, you know, Shakespeare took some poetry from Thomas Middleton, so now he's going to take some from Cruz. And we'll see where it goes. So it was a bold move. I knew Andrade was a bold move, but I felt good about it. And some of the reason I felt good about it is that I actually went to visit Macbeth's grave in Scotland, which is something I do with a lot of my plays. I go and either create altars, or if they're real people, try to visit where they've been buried. So it's sort of like creating a ritual around the entrance into their world and giving myself the permission to enter and do it with like humility and justice, like really trying to honor the original source, but also honoring my own voice, and then trying to take those two things and mix them together to create this new version.
This may sound strange, but it almost feels like that's what Kurosawa did in Throne of Blood.
Absolutely. I agree. I love his version. I don't know how I felt about what Polanski did. I mean, I don't like that tired thing about women to witches being old hags. I grew up in a culture where witches are real and magic is real and ghosts are real, and you know, and therefore it's just realism, not magic realism. It's like when you come from a place where you believe in magic and the supernatural is part of your life, then it is.
So are the witches then, you made mention of they might be queer people, is that correct?
That's really the idea of the director, Liam Vincent. And he had this idea to set it in Queens in the 1970s, not Queens, Brooklyn, in the 1970s, because that's the New York he knew. And he wanted to have the Macbeths be a lesbian couple. And I thought it was an interesting idea. So, you know, I was on board with it. But I didn't have to do very much changing of the script in order for that to happen. Because really, I mean, queer people are othered the way Puerto Ricans are othered, and the way people who don't ascend to a throne are othered. And so I thought it was a kind of a natural idea to sort of explore.
Does the play need sets? Are you trying to capture New York through sets? Are you trying to capture it through dialogue, through accents?
Those are all production questions, really, not really for me as the translator adapter. But I think what I've tried to do is create an environment with the language where it can go in different directions, where it can be set in different places, and which is what the director is moving towards. So his work with the designers, the design is very modern. The costuming is modern, modern from the 1970s. And noted it is disco time and blackout eras in New York. So he's taking all of these elements and creating an environment around the play that can sort of sustain the idea of this kind of crime family that has come up in 1970s Brooklyn and then wants to ascend to be, you know, the head of their group or their gang. So it's basically the same with a little bit different language around what kind of, it's not tribal. It's tribal in the sense that it's different groups fighting for one to be the head of something, the head of this crime family. But it's really based on, but all of the environment is going to be based on what the designers create, along with the director and the actors. Now, some of the actors are going to try to do accents. I don't know. Accents are tricky for me. I haven't been part of the rehearsal. I was part of a couple of workshops with the actors, but I haven't been there for rehearsals. It's been produced at universities and other theaters, but it's different versions. So this version at the Magic will have the, you know, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, and Banquo will all be women. And that'll be a different element. It'll be a smaller, more intimate cast of like 7 to 9 people, including the children. There will be children in the cast, which is exciting. The goal will be to have it read as modern without changing any of the language that I've already changed. I mean, I did also for this production, I added a new scene, which it hasn't been in any of the other productions. So it's been seen in other theaters, but it's never been seen in this permutation. It's not in this way. And so that's exciting because it also inspired me to write a new scene.
This is a different version in many ways.
Yeah, it is. It is. So it's interesting because I didn't think about it that way. But then the other day someone asked me about it and I was like, yeah, that's right. And then I think we might have given way too much about what the new scene is about. But I'm excited about the direction of that kind of adaptation, because that it's much even more so my play along with Shakespeare side by side.
Migdalia Cruz, let's talk a little bit about your career. As I said at the outset, you began as a playwright, and you have said that it all started when you were 6 years old at a marionette show and something grabbed you. What was that about?
Well, the inspiration from my first play that I wrote, which was a puppet play, came from a marionette show that I saw at school at PS 58. The Bill Bard marionettes would come to that one. That was the only bit of theater that ever came to the South Bronx when I lived there. So at PS 58, I think they did a production of Pinocchio. And I was just fascinated. I thought, wow, it just seems so filled with magic and delight, you know, and joy and sadness. That's, you know, the story of Pinocchio is actually quite a sad story. So I went home, I ran home, and I was like, all right, I got an idea for my first play. So I wrote a play. And my father helped me design the puppets, which was I had used a Spalding ball to be a black man. Then I made a bunch of Ku Klux Klansmen out of Kleenex tissues. And my play was called The Birth of a Man Means Death to the Klan. And the whole play was, you know, this man asks for his last request is he wants a cigarette. And then he asks them to light it. They give him a light. And of course, he lights them on fire. That was my socially political activist play at the 86 in the Bronx in the 1960s, which is a natural time to be thinking of those things. So that was during the civil rights movement, of course. So that's where it began, my idea of what theater should be or could be.
I understand that sometime later, a friend of yours was killed, raped and killed, but that would have been a decade later, perhaps.
No, it was actually 2 years later, 2.5.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we were eight and a half. And when my friend was murdered, I began to think about how people remember. What is the legacy of people? And how can I remember things if I'm not allowed to go to the funeral? Because my parents thought I was too young to be exposed to that much violence. Although I was exposed to violence every single day. Little did they know, you know, in the neighborhood. And I also think children have a capacity for understanding a lot more than parents give them credit for. But I decided I wanted to start writing things down, and so I wrote down a little story, a little essay about what happened that day and how I remembered it and the things I wanted to remember about her, about my friend Anita. So then I realized at that point, I was like, oh, so I think I need a record of my neighborhood. I think I need to start writing stories down because people aren't going to remember we were even here. And I think that's what happens a lot to impoverished neighborhoods where people just kind of disappear and no one stops to think, well, who were they? What were they? What could they have become? And what are their remaining joys and hopes despite all of the violence that was around them? So I began to think about it, but I kept it on the down low from my parents because they, you know, I went to Stuyvesant, as we talked about earlier, and I went into college as a math major. And I think they thought all along I was going to become a doctor or something that, you know, would get us out of the ghetto. And I had to tell them, you know, I'm going to be a writer, which they were like, what? I'm not going to make any money. Are you crazy? So I think they didn't understand it, first of all. And I think they were also disappointed that I would, like, it was like throwing away your brains or something. Why would you do that if you can do other things? You know, that doesn't make any money. That no one will pay attention to you if you're a writer. But I knew that I had to be, and it started then when I was six. And I did do some musicals. I did act. You were asking before if I had acted. I was in some musicals, and I could tap dance a little bit and sing. But the thing that made me happiest was when I wrote, because that felt like a true calling. Like I had a visceral experience when I wrote, and I felt like that was a worthy goal in a way that I could keep a record of human emotion. I could that this idea that you could put something down on paper that would express human emotion was very important to me. And finally, I had to admit it to myself. Yep, you're a writer, and I never turned back. You know, once I made that decision.
A quick aside here, which is kind of an subtext of what you and I went through at Stuyvesant is that the focus was so much on science and math that being a liberal arts kind of person put us in a little corner in high school. I mean, we were kind of pushed toward science or math. So I kind of get why you would be a math major, because that was Stuyvesant.
Yeah, and I loved math. I still love math, but it wasn't for me to do with my life.
Well, let me ask you then about math. The background you had in math on some unconscious level, do you think it in some way affects your writing, say, on a technical level?
I remember reading somewhere once that people who are in the sciences and people who are in the arts have the same kind of brain, that there's something about how your synapses, you know, fire off in order to create like a mathematical equation, which is the same as writing a piece of music, you know, and that way, and in music, you can see it more clearly, I think, than in writing. Well, you can see that mathematical brain would work that way. But for me, it's like, how do you plot a play? How do you follow an emotional journey? That also has an equation to it that is personal, you know, to each character. So I think once I started writing as professionally, I felt like I completely forgot all of my math. I remember when my daughter was in like fifth grade, thinking, what are you doing? What is base six? I had enough. I felt so awful that I forgot my math. It was like, oh my God, I lost a piece of me. But I think it is the same thing. I mean, I think any of those, and some of my best students have come from STEM too. So I find it interesting that there are so many good writers in those professions, but they're like, well, but I'm going to be an engineer. I'm going to do this or that. I'm like, oh, you're wasting your talent. Well, maybe not. My father would say, well, they're getting paid.
Magdalia Cruz, your path took you through playwriting. Usually at this point, I would ask someone like Lauren Gunderson, I would say, well, how did you first get produced? Things like that. But it sounds to me like your career kind of step by step takes you to being produced, that there was no giant like, oh my God, I'm being produced, because you had all this background, all this teaching.
Well, I think a big moment for me was when I began to study with Maria Irene Fornes at Intar Theater in New York, because there I began to understand how one could have a career. Like I didn't have a career yet. I had degrees in playwriting, one from Lake Erie College in Ohio and one from Columbia University in New York. But I still felt like I didn't know how to write a play. Like I felt like I hadn't figured out the formula for myself. Not that writing is a formula, but it's sort of like, how do I proceed? How do I find a career? But meeting Irene, I mean, she really taught me like how to look back at my memories and remember to remember, I always say. Like she taught me how to use my memories to ground my characters. And so I never got that far from my neighborhood again. Because I think I had this idea that writers was to write science fiction or something really different from, which going back to my Stuyvesant days, like we were all reading science fiction in the 70s, right? But I felt like my writing, where I could have a unique voice and had a unique story to tell, was for me to go back to the Bronx, and the idea of who I came from, where I came from, and then who I later became. So that I was constantly renewing my memories, and going back to who I was. So that was a landmark thing for me to study with Irene, and I studied with her for about five years, and through her I had my first professional production, because she arranged for a production at the Theater for the New City in New York City for all of her students at the time. There was like nine of us at the time who had a production with her. And they were all one acts, and she included one act that she wrote that all took place inside a box. That was her idea. It was called The Box Plays, and she had somebody design a box, and the outside was red and the inside was green, and all these plays had to take place. That was their only unifying structure, is that they had to take place in this box on stage. So that was my first production, and then from there I just kept writing, and I think the more I studied with her, the more I understood what I wanted to say. And then from there, I got into Sundance with one of my plays, with the Sundance Theater Festival. And I also got into New Dramatists, which is a very prestigious organization in New York. And And I was just surprised that all this was happening to me so young. So I was like 27, 28. And I was just really lucky and blessed that these things happened to me at that time. And so from then on, it was like encouraged that you sort of go on a snowball thing. And then I went into, I got something produced in Chicago at Latino Chicago Theater Company. And that's the place where I really felt I honed my voice. I was their writer in residence for about 8 years. And in that time, I wrote, I don't know, 7, 8 plays. And they were all produced by them and by this wonderful ensemble of actors. And it was a place that I felt like it was okay to fail. So they would produce things as I wrote them. I didn't feel harnessed by a theater company. I wasn't worried about the critics. Though, of course, you always do about the critics because they're critics. It was a place that was a home for my writing. You know, and that really helped me to develop.
Quick question then. You say, I was free to fail. Define what you mean by fail.
I think I sometimes wrote things either that, you know, that weren't appreciated. Like I just said, don't worry about the critics. That critics didn't appreciate or didn't understand. But I think failing for me was also not writing it as well as I should, or writing it too fast, or coming to the wrong conclusion of it. But then I was able to, at Latino Chicago, I was able to go back and address those problems, and that also the ensemble would hold me up. Like the actors were really great, and there would be suggestions from people. And Juan Ramirez, who was the artistic director, was very supportive of my work. And so he would say, you know, he would encourage me to do things that maybe I thought I shouldn't do, or I had some idea that I was going to do it wrong. And he was like, well, what does it matter? Just do it. You don't know you're going to do it wrong until you've done it.
If you're writing and you realize something's not working, it's pretty easy. You just press the erase button. But you're talking about failing when you're watching the ensemble on stage and you're listening and you're going, that shouldn't work, or are you waiting for critics? When you're trying to improve your work and you see something's not working, how does that happen for you?
I think I'm my worst critic. I think I'm constantly looking and trying to make whatever I'm doing the best it can be. So I think I'm kind of hypercritical. I think I got that from Stuyvesant too. Hypercritical of my work, and because I want it to be perfect. And I think this idea of perfection, of course, is a false one. But I think my own drive is to continue to work on something. So I might write something, go, oh, I think I need to rewrite that, or I need to write a different version, or next time, or it's going to get published, I'm going to add another monologue. That happened with a play of mine, Miriam's Flowers. Like I said, there's a voice missing here, and I thought I need a monologue for the father, and I put it into the published version. And subsequently, there were some productions that didn't have that monologue in it, and some did. But for me, it's like it's ever evolving. How it is to be a successful writer means you're always listening and always rewriting.
Is it easier for you to figure out, rather than say pass or fail, let's say problem solved, problem existing, is it easier to see it on paper? Does it only come up if you're watching an actor do it? For you, Migdalia Cruz, how does that work? How does that process work?
I think it happens both ways. I think sometimes I see an actor struggle with language that I've put into a play, and I go, oh, I need to make that seem easier in their mouth. Something, I did something wrong, or I did something that's not comfortable for that particular actor. That doesn't mean I would change it forever. It might mean I change it just for the production. When I'm dealing with paper, back then when I started my career, I was writing on paper. I had those giant computers, you know, or I had a Selectric at one point. It wasn't that easy to erase the way it is today, which I think actually made my writing better, because I think there's something really important about putting pen to paper and being able to see your mistakes on paper and crossing things out and being able to go back and say, oh, that, I crossed out that word, but I think that's better. And you can still see it. Whereas on a typewriter or a word processor, you can't see that at all. You make things disappear, which I think is a bad thing. I'm from the era of many drafts. And my husband, you've got to get rid of all these drafts, but they're important to me because they're different. They're about the development of the actual play.
Yeah. Have you ever had a situation where you've written something and it's perfect for you and you understand it, and then you see it live and you realize that it's still perfect, but it's actually better because of what the actor did?
I think it has happened that I felt like the actor cracked something in the character that helped me see the character in a different way. I don't think I'd ever say that they like made such a big change that I would be like, oh, they rewrote the whole play. But I feel like I have had that experience with a really good actor that they get to the essence of something and I go, oh, that's how it should be said. Oh, I don't need that extra word that they actually forgot to say. So that made it better. So I don't have to like go back and say, oh, you missed an and there, you missed a the. It's like really like, how is language comfortable in an actor's mouth? How does the actor make the character come to life? And I've changed things because actors have like, like massaged the language, I would say, not just changed it, like, you know, went into it and with all their psychology and sometimes made things better. But I think it takes two to tango. I don't think it's just like one or the other. I think it's like, you know, if you have a good text and you have great actors and you put those things together, you can really create something beautiful together. I think that's how I see it.
In 1997, you gave an interview where you talked about perhaps writing for television or film. What kept you in theater?
First of all, that's my first love. I love theater. And I think the television and film seem like a weird and forbidding place, particularly television. And I think it required a certain kind of abandonment of your, not morality, but your voice in some ways. You sort of have to give in to the format of television. I still hope one day to write some fabulous films, but TV is something different. I mean, TV has its own kind of, alchemy that you have to hook into to make really good TV. And there is really good TV. But I felt like what I really liked was making really good theater. At some point in my career, I was actually getting produced all the time, you know, and then I had a child and things changed. I wanted to stay home more and I wasn't traveling as much. And I felt like to be a playwright, you have to kind of be itinerant and travel with your plays to keep getting better. And I didn't want to travel quite so much when I had my daughter. I kind of thought, oh, I'm going to stay a little closer to home and see what happens here with this child that became also a playwright.
Have you ever thought about writing novels?
Yes. Recently, you know, now that I'm close to retirement age, but I'm not ever going to retire, of course, because, you know, writers don't have to, thank goodness. But I keep thinking that'll be my next thing, to write a novel. And there's so many playwrights that go in that direction. I'm just kind of waiting till I have something really interesting to say that I can only say in a novel. I feel sometimes people write their memoirs before they've lived. When I have something to say, it'll appear to me. So I'm kind of trusting that. But a novel would be great.
Migdalia Cruz, let's move in a somewhat different direction. We are in the age of Trump. Does that change your perspective on writing plays in the sense that there's something permanent about a play when it's written? And there's something ephemeral about living on this particular day and this particular time. When you are writing, are you even thinking of that distinction?
I think I deal with them the way I've always dealt with them. I've always come from a place there that it was violent. So that there's more violence in the world, still unresolved, doesn't surprise me. Wouldn't really change anything about what I want to write about. But I do find myself writing a lot about fascism. And I would say that in order to really explore those topics, like authoritarian governments, you don't write about an authoritarian government. You write about something in your fantasy that it has that authoritarian angle on it. Or so that you're looking at the world, your worldview is contained within the play. So, for instance, I'm working on a musical about the Nazi occupation of Paris in the 1940s, centered around the Hotel Ritz. And it's about, children that are hiding, Jewish children that are hiding in the walls of the Ritz in the back stairs. And it has all these famous characters from the 40s, like Herman Goering and Coco Chanel and Josephine Baker is there, and Hemingway makes a little entrance. So I'm writing about them and that time, but I'm also thinking about how much it still reflects in today's society. So I think the more successful plays that are about our current times are plays that look back at history and remind people, like, this is not the first time this has happened. And it makes people think, why is this happening again? And I don't have to, like, hit somebody on the head and say, hey, you know, this is really horrible times. We are in the middle of all these illegal wars. Guess what? We've always been in the middle of some illegal war. And didn't we, create this country from a genocide? So there's already a karmic thing in the United States of America that is kind of dark. And we have to keep remembering. That's always going to be in the zeitgeist, right? That's always going to be in the back of your mind. So whatever you write, if I want to write a love story, there is a certain darkness that sometimes it comes upon it, I feel like, because of what's happening in society, right? So I would say that's what happens to me when I write about, and I am writing now about today and about fascism. So, but I'm not saying that now we are becoming fascist. But I can see the parallels, and making those parallels as a writer are very important. And also using history to tell all the lessons that we need to change today. That's, to me, the best you could do as a writer.
Kind of technical question. The yes. difference between writing dialogue and writing a long one-person monologue play?
I don't think I've ever written a long one-person monologue play. Have I? I'd have to think about that. I've written parallel monologue plays where, like, there's three people and they each have their own monologue going on. But I feel like monologue plays require, it's about usually about one event. And I feel like the longer they are, the more dispersing, the more the actual drama of the piece gets dispersed. But like really effective one-man shows, like I would say like Crap's Last Tape, which is a Samuel Beckett play, that's effective because there are things that are changing throughout that monologue. It's not just one man talking, straight at the audience all the way through. But that you understand that there's a life is being changed throughout. So that makes it effective. But it's really not, that's not really my style of writing. I don't usually write those long kind of monologues. I tend to like bigger plays than that, or more with more characters.
How about a one act versus a two act? And how do you deal with second act problems? Because, well, we know that a lot of plays have second act problems.
Right. That happens more often in musicals, I think. But for me, I like long one acts. I like full length one acts because I hate letting people go. I don't even get up during intermissions in a play. I like being kept in the sustained suspense of being in a drama. So I like 90 to 2 hour plays that go without intermission, and you really are there for a sustained period of time with these characters. I also like during intermissions, people go and they drink and they talk too much. It's like, sit down and listen, have the experience. But I might be alone in that feeling. I don't know. But I've never liked intermissions. I have written plays with act breaks, but often I've written a three act play, but the act break is taken after the second act. So for me, acts are about, like, have you told a sustained story for that one piece of time? And then you can let people go. But I prefer to really extend the dramatic moment and do those long one-act plays.
You love Beckett, but Beckett often makes us sometimes think, but often it makes us scratch our heads. When you're working on a play, are you thinking in any way about that response from the audience, one way or the other?
No, I'm not. I think you can't. I mean, for me, it's not interesting to figure out what the audience is thinking. I have enough trouble figuring out what the characters are thinking. So, but I feel like if the characters are well written, that the audience will understand what you're saying and will see something of themselves in the characters. that's when I think plays go wrong. It's like if you start writing things, because you want an effect. Like that goes back to your question about what do you think about, you know, writing the time of Trump? I'm still doing it. He hasn't shot me yet. The day may come when all the intellectuals get taken out, like they did in Cambodia in Pol Pot's time, where they shot all the intellectuals and people who wore glasses and wanted to change the culture by going back to square one. We never know when that's going to happen again. And it can happen here because can happen anywhere. So I feel like I don't try to second guess what the audience will think. I try to write my character so they're taking a real journey that I hope is interesting to the audience.
You did write a play about Cambodia.
I did.
And you researched it over there and talked to survivors. How was that experience for you?
Yeah. Well, somebody wrote in some newspaper that I took the grand tour of suffering. I thought that's kind of a strange way to say it, but okay. Yeah, newspapers. But what happened was I was chosen to be a part of a cultural contingent that we traveled to Cambodia, we traveled to India, and we met the Dalai Lama and met Tibetan refugees. We traveled to, we were supposed to go to Bosnia, but the war had broken out more because it was 1995. So I ended up, we only got as far as Croatia, but we met Bosnian refugees in camps in Croatia. So it was a play that was about the effect of war on children. So I met children and young adults in all those places to create this play. I was traveling with Yolanda King, the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr., Danny Hawk, the performance artist, and a few other people that were part of this organization called Children of War that did, what is that word called? It's where you put two sides together, two opposite sides, and make them talk. That's like crisis intervention. It's a word. There's a phrase for what that is. So they would go in these places. Like, for instance, they went to Palestine and had Palestinian kids talk to Israeli kids and discuss the war and how it affected, you know, both sides, and have them actually exchange, you know, their feelings and their ideas about why these things happen. And so it's sort of about how do children maintain their hope in all these war-torn places. So going to Cambodia, I forget what your original question was, but that's why I went to write this play. It was about the effect of war on children. And I ended up writing a play called Featherless Angels. That was a play with puppets, going back to puppets. All of the violence was shown with puppets, puppetry.
I have friends in Cambodia now, so I've been there a couple of times. The very first time I was there, I was in Siem Reap, obviously, to see Anger. And I did go to one of the shrines, the Killing Fields shrines, and saw the skulls.
I saw that too. Yeah. It's just a devastating place when you go to it. It's like you can't believe it. And what was even more devastating was to meet these young adults that had been children who had guns thrusted into their arms and said, kill your uncle, kill your father. We're going to kill all the elders of your village and you're going to do it. And they were children when they were told to do this. It was interesting because of course I'm a big crybaby. So they're telling me these stories and I'm sobbing. They told me that they enjoyed seeing me cry because they forgot how to cry. Because when they were children, they would kill you if you cried. So they learned to laugh instead of cry. So it's like, wow, that's so deep and so profoundly painful to hear from these young adults that they don't remember, they don't feel safe crying, they don't feel safe having, you know, sad emotions and showing their pain, that they have to constantly cover it with laughter. I just thought that was, you know, and to me that seemed like an enormous part of what the Cambodian culture had created, and what Pol Pot had created around him was a bunch of people that did not know how to cry anymore. And I know it's changed some since Pol Pot went away, but it's a dark place. But it's a dark place full of people that still have hope. And how the hell does that happen? To me, that was amazing.
I've been there more recently in 2016 and then 2024. And the people I know are all, you know, they're all post Pol Pot, and I have to ask about the parents or grandparents. And there's a certain wall. They talk about it in kind of vague terms, and their parents were alive, but it's as if that's not something you want to look back on, similar to, I guess, my late stepfather was one of the people who freed the camps in World War II, and he never talked about it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's such a dark thing to revisit. And that's where actually the writer comes in handy. You have to go to those places all the time. I mean, in imaginations.
Working on translations for you, how do you maintain the playwright's voice? Do you try to keep yourself out of it? Translating from Spanish to English, actually Spanish becomes more poetic when it's translated into English. When I read something like Garcia Marquez, Lorca. But for you, do you try to find equivalents? Do you do straightforward? How does that work in translating a play?
Yeah, when I translated from Spanish plays into English, was I did a program called The Lark, Mexico New Word Exchange, where they paired up English-speaking playwrights, English-speaking Latinx playwrights with playwrights from Mexico City. So we had to translate their plays into English. And what I found about that program that was good is that they paired a playwright with the playwright, because that's a very different translation than a playwright and a scholar. The scholar will do the by the book, go through the dictionary word by word, and sometimes it seems awkward or you don't quite catch the original poetry of the originating language. But for me, I felt that I worked on plays that already had a sensibility that matched my own. So I didn't feel like I was, you know, going to change their words in ways that were not good for them, that I found an equivalent in English that met and matched their poetry. So that's how I did. And I also went through word by word and made sure I understood all the phrases. And my Spanish is okay, but it's not great. So, you know, so I didn't have to use dictionaries. But then when I got all the words down, I was like, okay, what is he really saying? What is she really saying? What are they saying about the world? And how do we say that here? Like if they're on the subway in New York City, that's different than if they're on a subway in Mexico City. How do you create an equivalent that makes it sing to a different audience that speaks a different language?
Well, that brings us back to Macbeth. I mean, you're not fully wedded to Shakespeare, but at the same time, can you always find equivalents?
I did.
Okay.
I mean, I think you can. I think you cannot. You may not be able to put it in iambic pentameter the way he did, but you can come close to it. The thing about English that I love about writing in English is that it's such an ugly language. It's not Spanish. It's not Portuguese. It's not French. It's not lyrical. Even Russian is prettier than English. English is hard and in some ways violent. And I always felt that English was like the perfect language for my work because it was direct. And in order to create poetry out of this very harsh language, you really have to understand poetry, and you have to understand how poetry is not just words, but, you know, syntax and juxtaposition and all those things that Shakespeare also understood, of course, right? So I feel like that's, you know, that's the way you do it. You have to go through, and if you're not finding it, for me as a playwright, I wouldn't translate something that I felt like I didn't have a connection to.
In all of this discussion, you talk about violence in English, violence in America, and violence in your plays. Do you see a limit to what you can show? I mean, maybe because I see so many violent films, I'm kind of almost used to bloodletting now that I wouldn't have been 30 years ago. The question of is, do you go too far? How do you stop?
Well, I think in film, it's very different, because in film that you're really showing violence. You can actually recreate it. In a play, you don't want to do that. You want to make the poetic choice. If somebody bursts into gets exploded by a bomb, like in my play Featherless Angels, let's say, about the effect of war on children, if a child had exploded, you would see red ribbons come out of their body. You wouldn't see blood. Do you know what I mean? So that you find some kind of poetic choice that or a substitute that's not about blood and gore and literal, what all that literal stuff that you can get in the film. In the play, you want to be theatrical. You want to use all those things that we talked about very early on. What does the production do? Like the costumes and the set and the lighting and the actor and how, you know, you can, a person can burst into flames by not showing and, you know, not having to flick a match. How do you show that in a play? How do you show that on a stage? That's, to me, that's the power of theater, is that you can do that in a way that is poetic and that is not literal. And that makes it, makes the journey, I think, much more palatable, but also much more beautiful and much more visceral. Like if you're watching it, it's, it, it invites you in to experience it as opposed to, oh no, somebody's head just got blown off. I have to run into the kitchen and have a cup of coffee. That's not going to happen in the theater. In the theater, you're going to be gripped, hopefully, by the actor and the words and the whole production to stay and watch and hopefully experience something that, you know, that you'll take away or make you think about it later. You know, it, that it's not something that just goes away after you turn off your TV. It is something that should last with you.
Migdalia Cruz, how do you know when you're writing that a play has ended?
I write the end. No, sometimes I do feel like I do that. I'm like, okay, I where do I go? I'm going to say, but the one thing I've taken to writing at the end of my plays is I write the end for now. Because I feel like, do I know it's the end? I'm feeling like it's the end. I feel like I've told the story, but maybe there's another story or a further place I want to go in 5 years with this play. So I write the end for now because it feels to me the more honest way to end a play. Because to be so sort of black and white about how do I get to the end of my story, to just, maybe you haven't, but you've come to the end of the way you feel like you've told one journey completely. And you go, oh, I think the story is told. And do I want to continue it? Or does it feel like this is it? Have I gotten to 90 minutes? Have I gotten to 100 minutes? Do I have people there for 5 hours? And, you know, there have been plays that are that long, of course. But I don't think I've written them. I have one play that's quite long called Salt, which I love, which is actually an adaptation of a John Ford play, Tis Pity She's a Whore, that takes place in Chicago. And that play is long. And so that's a three-act play. But that one that one's like condemnation of the Catholic Church, and it has all these political ramifications, plus it has, you know, child prostitutes in it. So it takes a long time to develop. So I feel like once I've told the story completely and I can close my eyes, and also when I stop dreaming about the play, I feel like, okay, that's the end.
What other plays during 2026 do you have coming up, produced? Anything?
I don't have anything else so far in 2020. Oh, well, I have a new commission. I'm not sure I'm supposed to tell anybody about it, but I have a new commission that's for a short play that's about democracy. That's going to happen in November, I think, during the midterm elections. And I think that's the only other thing I have besides my magic Macbeth. Yeah, I'd like to produce some of my plays. I've written 66 of them, I think. I would love them all in rep somewhere.
How many plays right now do you have that you're still just screwing around with, working on, coming back to?
I have four. I have four, maybe there's five, that I haven't had productions of yet that I would love to see produced. There's a play that I just mentioned, Salt, which is an adaptation of Tis Pity She's a Whore. There's another play called Never Moscow, which is about Chekhov. I have another play that's called Fish Tank, which is about two middle-aged sisters who have to clean up their parents' house after the parents died during COVID, and they meet ghosts inside the parents' house. And that takes place in the Bronx. That's called Fish Tank. And what's my other play? Oh, there's a play called The Two Roberts, which is about Roberto Cofresí, who's a Puerto Rican pirate from the 1890s, the 18-teens, and Robert Johnson, the Delta Blues master. So it's the two Roberts, and they meet in purgatory and fuck how they both sold their souls for their talents. Roberto for, you know, being able to sail the sea and avoid the Spanish fleet, and Robert Johnson to get his talent at blues guitar. So that's that play. So if somebody would produce those four plays, I think I could die easily. I mean, peacefully, I should say. I would like to see all of my plays produced. And I do write a lot. There's times when I just go, have I written too many plays and I should just like stop and, I don't know, become a cashier at CVS, which is seems to be the fate of anybody over 60. But I feel like I have things I have to say. So I'm just going to keep saying them and maybe somebody will produce them.
You've been listening to an interview with Migdalia Cruz, playwright, and Macbeth will be at the Magic Theater in Fort Mason Center from March 18th through April 5th. And for more information, you can go to magictheater.org. And to find out more about Migdalia Cruz, you can go to her website, which is migdaliacruz.com. And you could also look her up on Wikipedia.
Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio shows on Facebook.